We are dealing with some of the greatest challenges humanity's ever faced, you know, in terms of displacement, in terms of climate change. And these are complex and difficult things, and they're not going to be easily solved. So it kind of requires a bit of heavy lifting to get in and to kind of really understand these things. And not everyone's going to agree with my point of view. Not everyone's going to agree with yours. And that's fine, because we live in a democracy, but we do need to learn how to disagree again. And I think a way to do that is to expose yourself to other arguments, read widely, and read critically with a view of, well, who is telling me this, and why are they telling me this, and what's the position they're coming from? And once you start doing that, it becomes quite clear the kind of rationale behind information being put out, so that you can understand, you can see pretty clearly what's misinformation and what's designed to manipulate. But it does require a bit of work.
Welcome to Justice Matters, the podcast inspiring a world where everyone belongs. I'm your host, Tim Buxton. Today's guest on the podcast is the Pacific editor for The Guardian, Ben Doherty. Now, I met Ben back in 2015. I had returned with my family for a brief trip back from Iraq, where we were living at the time, and he was so intrigued by what we were doing over there in the face of the ISIS crisis, caring for families that had fled, that he actually wrote an article. And I remember sitting in his home in Bondi with his family around, and as we shared and talked, and I really felt such a connection actually with Ben, and was really just excited to be able to now be able to turn the tables on him and get him on the podcast and hear his story and what has influenced his life. He's someone that has spent his career, 2 decades now, sharing about issues of human rights and injustice around the world. As a result, he was awarded 3 Walkley Awards, one of the highest honours in journalism in Australia, as well as 3 United Nations Media Peace Awards. Again, an incredible honour for anyone working in this craft in the area of journalism here in Australia. And as we talk and discuss many issues surrounding human rights issues and just in general, the whole idea of using journalism, using your voice to shed a light on injustice and hopefully bring freedom, I know that you're going to be inspired to use whatever you've got in your hands. Without further ado, here's my discussion with Ben Doherty.
Journalism, and I don't want to be too sort of strong about it, but there is a kind of vocational element to journalism. Like it, you know, telling stories is a very fundamental human condition. The way we relate to others, the way we understand a, you know, a complex and capricious world, is to kind of put narratives around things and to give things a story arc and to give things an understanding. And journalism states that to a degree. You know, why is this happening? Why is there this conflict? Why is this happening in this place? And journalism seeks to answer those questions. So there's something kind of very sort of atavistic and fundamental about journalism. I'd always grown up in a house that my parents read newspapers, both from Australia and overseas. We watched, you know, the ABC News religiously at 7 o'clock every night. And this is the days before, you know, iPads or computers, so I couldn't go off and watch my own thing on Netflix. That didn't exist, so it was ABC News every night. So I grew up with a sense of the, I suppose, and again, I don't want to lean on this too heavily, but that sort of fourth estate role of journalism and the importance of media and journalism and the role of journalism in a democratic society and holding governments to account in revealing matters of public interest, I suppose. So I had perhaps maybe an idealistic, you know, idea around what journalism was, but it always interested me because it seemed to me that journalism gave you a kind of front row seat to sort of absolutely extraordinary happenings. You know, you got to see fascinating people doing extraordinary and deeply powerful and important things, and you got a front row seat and you got to ask questions about it and to write about it. You know, I was just reflecting this week with this this dreadful coup in Myanmar, that I was in Myanmar in 2010 when Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house arrest. And I remember standing at the barricades when the military dropped the barricades and running the 400 metres or so with, you know, surrounded by Myanmar's people screaming, "Dorsu, Dorsu," running to her front gate, being at the front gate and being very aware at the time, you know, all the while trying to write notes and write my copy for the next day's paper, but being supremely conscious that, you know, this was history being made. And, you know, you kind of had a front row seat to it, and we can, you know, reflect on Dorsu's behavior and action since. But I suppose that sense of helping to write in very rough terms, you know, that first draft of history as they kind of call journalism, felt to me to be a hugely, you know, intoxicating thing to do, like a fascinating profession. So I kind of fell into journalism, you know, completely by accident. I saw there was a cadetship, not by accident, quite deliberately, but in a kind of slightly backdoor manner, in that I saw there was a cadetship advertiser, the Bendigo Advertiser, and I got in my car from Melbourne and drove up to Bendigo and knocked on the editor's door and said, "I'm your new cadet." And he kind of said, "That's very funny. You can put your CV on the pile." And I said, "Look, I'm going to be in town for a week.
Wow.
Can I bring you some stories?" And I brought him stories for a week. And at the end of the week, he gave me the job. And so, you know, from there, I went from Bendigo to Canberra to Melbourne and then overseas. And so you just kind of keep looking for the next story, I suppose, and it sort of unfolded from there.
Mate, you know, as you're kind of just sharing, you know, your journey into journalism, what draw you into almost that idealistic, you know, front row seat, telling the truth, holding people to account, being part of change in society, you know, writing the narratives, telling the stories that need to be told. It seems though, however, there's like, at least from my perspective, with the rise of misinformation, journalism seems to be in a crisis to a certain degree. And how does that make someone like you feel, who's like dedicated their life to it? What are some of the, what would you tell listeners, you know, in this moment, is the most important thing, especially within the world of journalism?
I don't think it's too strong to say that journalism is in crisis, and it's in crisis on a number of fronts. Certainly on the sort of business level, which lots of people talk about how the industry kind of survives and is viable, but even on a more existential level about what its purpose is, and the way journalism is performed, because we have seen this democratization of information sources, and that in lots of ways is a great thing. That everybody now is allowed to be part of the public debate. You know, the kind of idea of the ancient Greek idea of the fora, you know, the town square where ideas can be debated, and that really old fashioned kind of sense of a contest of ideas is now open to everyone. It's not just open to newspaper barons or people who own TV stations. So in lots of ways, that democratization of information is a great and powerful thing. But you can also see how powerful it is when it is deliberately misused for misinformation to you know, promote hate speech, to promote dangerous medical messages, which is what we're seeing in the world now, but used by people to manipulate others, and you know, to incite insurrection even. So it is. I mean, and again, you know, we meant when we were talking before we started the recording, Tim, about, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. There is power in words. There is power in information, and it does need to be used. It does need to be used carefully, and it does need to be used with an understanding of its power. And this is not to say that journalism should be strictly regulated and, you know, a government or some sort of authority should be able to say, "You're a journalist, you're not a journalist, you're a journalist, you're not." But I think there is a responsibility on those of us who do practice journalism and call ourselves journalists to do it in a responsible fashion. And people might not agree with everything I write or everything that The Guardian says. But the idea is that information is presented in good faith and with rigor and with an idea of informing the public, with an idea of contributing in a meaningful way to that contest of ideas. I think people putting information into the world deliberately trying to mislead people or incite violence or incite hatred is hugely damaging and needs to be called out and needs to be condemned whenever it's seen, and needs to be kind of squashed, as hard as possible and countered very, very quickly. Now, it's very easy for me and you to see it, see here and say that and say, oh, we need to stop misinformation. But, you know, the old Churchill quote about the lie being halfway around the world by the time the truth has got its boots on sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it is. It's a really difficult thing to do. And I think what that then leads us to is, well, what do, you know, and I don't love the word consumers, but people who are reading news and reading news online and those sort of things, what can they do to sort of, you know, I suppose to prevent the spread of misinformation and to prevent themselves being misled by this? And my answer to that is to read widely and to read critically, to read lots of news sources, to read news sources that you don't think you're going to agree with. You know, get outside your bubble, read opposing ideas and debates, and be prepared to kind of sort of do the hard work in your own mind to work through these things. We are dealing as a global community and as national societies and as smaller communities, we are dealing with some of the greatest challenges humanity's ever faced, you know, in terms of displacement, in terms of climate change. And these are complex and difficult things, and they're not going to be easily solved. So it kind of requires a bit of heavy lifting to get in and to kind of really understand these things. And not everyone's going to agree with my point of view. Not everyone's going to agree with yours. And that's fine, because we live in a democracy, but we do need to learn how to disagree again. And I think a way to do that is to expose yourself to other arguments, read widely and read critically with a view of, well, who is telling me this and why are they telling me this and what's the position they're coming from? And once you start doing that, it becomes quite clear the kind of rationale behind information being put out, so that you can understand. You can see pretty clearly what's misinformation and what's designed to manipulate. But it does require a bit of work.
Let me tell you about one of our partners, Freedom Broadband. They're an incredible profit-for-purpose business. Freedom Broadband is your all-in-one internet and telephone service provider, whether it's for your business or your home. Now, their internet connection and speeds are simply amazing, and they're in another league when it comes to the quality of their customer service. But here's what really sets them apart. When you switch to any of their services, they'll donate $5 every month to a nonprofit cause of your choice. As the founder of You Belong, an Australian-based nonprofit charity, one of the greatest challenges we face is fundraising. And I think I can speak for almost all leaders in the nonprofit world when I say that being able to have a residual income coming into your accounts to support your work is a dream come true. And like most nonprofits, our work is dependent on the generous support of individuals and groups that share our passion to empower refugees to integrate and thrive here in Australia. What that means is that we spend more time and energy looking for ways to raise support. And what I desperately love to be doing is spending that time and our limited resources developing and growing the many successful programs that we run. But here's where our friends at Freedom Broadband come in. You see, a few months back, I was on a 4G wireless connection at home through one of the largest phone and internet companies here in Australia. And each month I was nervous about going over our usage, getting a nasty bill at the end, and I was working on a lot of the podcasting and videos at home, and the speeds I was getting were just painfully debilitating. And I finally decided to give Freedom Broadband a call. And within 2 minutes, I was on the call with Graham completing my application. And within a week, I had completely switched over to their $79 a month unlimited plan. And I can tell you firsthand, the service has been phenomenal. And I have a direct line to their customer service team whenever I have a question or need assistance. Now the studio and office where I work has switched over to Freedom Broadband as well. We're on their business plan and we haven't looked back. And how cool is this? Little by little, connection by connection, Aussie owned and locally run Freedom Broadband is now actively supporting the great work of nonprofits in communities all around Australia. Simply by switching your internet to Freedom Broadband, you can help transform the lives of those less fortunate. And that's why I love these guys. Get this, head to freedombroadband.com.au and quote Justice Matters on your application form, and they will donate $50 from the activation fee to support Justice Matters. That's going to enable us to continue this podcast and inspire the world where everyone belongs. That's freedombroadband.com.au. Say goodbye to expensive, mediocre internet with poor customer service and hello to top-notch internet service and the good feeling of knowing you're supporting a great cause. Join Freedom Broadband today. Quote Justice Mattis and let's partner together with the internet that's helping to change the world.
I mean, and maybe that's part of the kind of, you know, democratic obligation that you have to be an informed and contributing member of your society. You know, to be that informed citizen is to kind of you are obliged to kind of do your due diligence, I suppose, on these issues that the world is wrestling with.
Yeah, you know, I think that element of curiosity we were talking about earlier, of there's so many ways to look at an object. You could look at it from the side, you could look at it like this, and as you do expose yourself again to being well-read, being critical, analyzing, and that critical in the sense of being curious, you know, don't just take something at face value, wrestle with it. And I mean, it's just brought such its enrichment and growth in my own life as I've allowed my own echo chambers to be blown apart, right? And what I think that's the scary thing is we see so many echo chambers growing and developing, and the danger can be to go from one echo chamber to another echo chamber too as well. So you change your views, but then you just become so engrossed and absorbed in where you've got to there. It's that ability to foster and to hold the tension of
differing worldviews and differing, yeah, and you're right, and the kind of solidifying walls around those echo chambers are getting harder and harder.
They're getting harder
to get out of, and this kind of, you know, and if you exist in one and don't know anything about the other, you know, they inexorably sort of drift apart, and then all of a sudden when you're trying to debate something, it becomes really difficult, and people have always had, you know, political disagreements. But in past generations, it feels to me as though we've been working from a kind of a foundational base of understanding of what reality is. But because we're getting so deep into these echo chambers, our realities are becoming different. Worldviews are becoming so difficult that we so different rather that we find it very difficult to kind of recognize the other. We find it very difficult to accept another's worldview and to sort of recognize another's humanity, and that leads us, I think, down a very difficult path. And so, you know, to get to your broader theme of justice, and I've been sort of rolling it around in my head the last few days, and one of the words that sort of came, and people talk about justice in terms of, you know, and they think of it in terms of equality and in terms of fairness, and all those sorts of things are absolutely correct. But the other word that came into my mind was imagination, and it struck me as a sort of slightly odd thought, and I sort of interrogated a little bit more. But justice as an act of imagination, I think, really interests me. Having the sort of the imagination and the courage as well to sort of consider another person's perspective, to see what the world looks like from their point of view, to be able to imagine yourself from somebody else's perspective, I think is a really powerful tool. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting way to finding a just solution. I have an idea about something. You have a contradictory view about it. I can't see how you would arrive at your position until I have the imagination to put myself in your shoes and from your perspective, and to be able to see the world from your point of view. So I think, in terms of finding justice, in terms of finding, you know, a just and equitable and fair solution for some of the world's great problems, we need to be able to imagine ourselves in another's place. And that's somebody else in my community who I might not agree with. That's somebody else in another country. That's somebody else from another culture. Someone whose background is completely different to mine. I need to have the imagination to be able to see their world as well as understand mine.
That reminds me of a quote by Brené Brown, who says, it's hard to hate people. It's hard to hate people up close. And it's this idea of when you listen to someone's story, their experience, like you said, you put yourself in someone's shoes, you imagine yourself in their story. It's very difficult to be indifferent it's very difficult to not care. It's very difficult to not see things in for your own opinions, thoughts, worldview to not be challenged and changed. And that is the beauty, I think, that I love in journalism. It's going into some of the most difficult, horrendous stories. I watched a Four Corners documentary on the Uyghurs in, I think, in Xinjiang. Yeah. And I don't know if I pronounced that right. But it was, again, just as I've kind of lived amongst the Yazidi genocide that took place, it took me back to this is happening again. And this has been happening and is happening elsewhere, we don't know. And listening to the stories, listening to the personal accounts and struggles of some of these, those that have been able to escape, it compels me to this. I cannot not do anything. I can't not unknow this anymore. I can choose to ignore it and move on, but it's left. I think that was one of my heroes, William Wilberforce. You know, talks about this. You cannot not do something about it once you've
Once you know, and there is a real watershed moment of once you've been exposed to this, like you say, you can't unknow those things.
No.
And you are compelled to do things. I thought that earlier quote from Brown was a really interesting one. It's hard to hate people up close, and I think that can be one of journalism's most powerful attributes, is to be able to tell those personal stories, to be able to reduce, kind of not reduce, but explain broad difficult issues in the singular, in the personal, can be incredibly powerful. And it is possible then to understand another person's story if you've heard their personal account, their personal situation, and you can relate to that. It's very hard to relate to a sort of large amorphous mob of people, but you can relate to one
statistics,
person.
Statistics
sort of wash over us like a wave and don't mean anything, but that one person's story, that one family story, that one child's story can sit and resonate with us. And I think that's one of the dangerous things we've seen in this country and in others around issues like asylum seekers and refugees, this idea that the language is dehumanizing and distancing, and it reduces people to this sort of amorphous, unknowable, and potentially threatening mob. So we hear about waves of migrants, and we talk about floods of illegals and this sort of hugely pejorative language. Whereas these are all individual people, once you get to know those individual stories, those barriers break down very quickly. And it's always the case where, when countries are talking about issues around migration and these sorts of things, it's sort of like, I don't like migrants, but the Bangladeshis down the street I love. They're a great family sort of thing. Once you get to know people, all of those barriers fall down. And so I think we need to be really careful around, we're talking about misinformation, those sort of things, and the kind of deliberate use of language to kind of manipulate public understanding of things. We've seen in Australia, we don't have asylum seekers arriving anymore. We have illegals. We don't have an immigration department. We have a border protection force. All of these sort of semantic changes, you think, they're just words sort of thing, but they do change people's fundamental understanding of what's happening. And I think you need, and that goes to that.
Language is powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Words make worlds. And so as we were talking about reading critically before, that's part of it, is to understand why are they talking about this in that way? What position is this coming from? What point are they trying to make in using the language that they do?
Yeah, when I just had an interview with an incredible, inspiring woman. She leads a social enterprise, one of the largest in the US, that helps those that are formerly incarcerated to integrate into society, providing them jobs. And she talks about, that precise issue within the US justice system of there's this kind of language around we've got to be tough on crime and all of these strong emotive language that appeals. What I've always found personally is when I hear politicians on both sides appealing to whether it be fear-dominated language. That's a powerful emotion. And on the other, you know, quite often on the on more left sides, you can see you can hear a motivation towards shame, like shaming people into, you know, how could you think differently or have another view and opinion? And against these are very powerful things. Well, I guess I don't want to be seen as a bigot, or I don't want to be seen like this, so therefore I will not, will not, you know, express my view. But what if we were led by compassion, you know, instead of shame, right? Like instead of, and what if we were led by like courage or this ideas of, you know, I've always, the things I've done in my life, whenever I've taken a risk, if it was motivated by compassion and courage, those are the times in my life when I've been most proud. Whenever I've been motivated by fear or shame, it's never, never borne any good fruit, really. You could look back at a number of things.
I think that's a really interesting point you make, that and it takes and this is, you know, to your eternal credit, you know, a great deal of self-awareness and kind of self-confidence to be able to interrogate your own motives and say, well why am I doing this? Why do I feel this way? Why am I acting in this way? And to be honest with yourself, to say, it is, I am doing this out of fear.
Am I voting because I'm afraid, or am I voting because I want to create a better, because I'm voting for what I want to create?
You know? Precisely. And I think that's a hugely admirable thing, and a courageous thing to be able to sort of look inside yourself and say, well, what are the real motivations here? And I think that goes a long way into understanding your own motivations, but then also the motivations of others with whom you might agree or you might not.
Look, I'd love to hear some of your own, the issues that are dear to your heart. You kind of referenced immigration and look, you're a foreign correspondent for almost 2 decades. I mean, you've been in this gig for a while. You've got a decorated career, mate. I think it's worth noting, you know, you don't get to 3 UN Media Peace Awards and 3 Walkley Awards. Those are, I'm sure, you know, peer recognized accolades you're real proud of, but I want to know the stories and the issues that birthed the incredible work that you've done and that has been duly recognized. Like what are the issues dear to your heart that take me back to some of the things that have kind of just along the way just.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's really interesting the stories that stay with you. I mean, as a journalist, you write lots of stories and you're interested in lots of things. But the ones that stay with you aren't, you know, and the awards is a thing that kind of, you know, happens if you live for a very long time, like I have. But I suppose they're not necessarily the stories that kind of that live with you and resonate with you and kind of and sort of fill you up, I suppose, in Australia, you know, in a real sense of fulfillment of, you know, I'm making a difference here. So I was South Asia correspondent based in New Delhi, and I spent about 18 months on an investigation, going up into the Punjab, into places around Jalandhar and these sorts of places, looking into the sports ball industry and the way it was using child labour in an egregious and extreme way, that little girls, in particular girls, were being dragged out of school and forced to stitch balls for 8-10 hours a day, you know, with these big heavy needles stitching footballs, and the kind of cruel and horrible irony of it was they were making these, you know, girls who were 7 and 8 and 10 years old were making sports balls for children on the other side of the world to play with, and the kind of juxtaposition of this child being forced into work so this child can have a game of football and that, you know, can play in their backyard, was you know, intensely painful to see, and you know, and a kind of an incredibly stark demonstration of the inequality in the world. So it was a difficult story. There were sort of legal, you know, dramas, you know, difficulties in trying to tell this story, and we needed to protect those people who were talking to us from, you know, from recriminations and retribution, those sort of things. The power imbalance in telling these stories between these powerful people who controlled these factories and these poor families who were sort of compelled to work, I suppose, in an almost bonded sense. So it was a very complicated story in that way, and difficult for people to talk about because, you know, this was illegal, and this was kind of, you know, morally hugely problematic as well. So it was a really difficult story to tell. But, you know, after 18 months and I think 6 or 7, you know, long visits over numerous days, to be able to truly sort of live inside this story and understand it properly, we managed to get this story out, and it made a huge impact back in Australia. There was, you know, very high profile brands that were involved and were forced to, you know, change their practices immediately. You know, pulling balls off the shelves, they had to sort of restructure the way they worked in these countries, so that the families and children in particular weren't exploited. But the most valuable thing that came out of it was that the company that was employing children agreed to find the child labourers that it had exploited and that it had used, and to put them in school. And it went around and it found upwards of 30 girls.
Oh,
and
it
put them in school and paid for them to go to school. And
oh my gosh,
that was a minor bit of a follow up story. But
I'm always tearing up listening to that.
In the scheme of things, you know, it's not immense, but to those little girls, it was like it changed the direction of their lives. And you know, you and your listeners will know as well as anyone that, you know, the power of education, particularly having girls
young
in schools,
girls,
and the transformative effect that has. But just to know that those little girls got an education as a result of that is hugely rewarding. And just to know, however small that impact is, that it was a massive impact for those little girls who I've kept in touch with over the years, worked with their families through certain sort of intermediaries, and they're doing well, and their lives have taken a different direction. So those little things, you know, journalism doesn't often make a difference, and journalism comes in for criticism a lot of the time, and often justifiably. You know, we don't always get things right, but every now and then you can make a difference. So something like that is something I'm immensely proud of. There's another story about an asylum seeker called Faisal Chagani, who came to Australia from Iran having suffered brutal persecution, who died on Christmas Island, having been held within Australia's system for 4 years, having been treated abysmally all the way through, and suffered enormously. And at so many points along his journey, people within the system were crying out for him to be helped, and the system didn't do anything to help him, and he ultimately died on Christmas Island. And it's a story I've returned to several times over. And I suppose, you know, to go to the theme of our discussion today, seeking a measure of justice for Faisal, I can't do anything to redress the imbalances that he suffered in his life and the injustices he suffered in his life. But I can seek to make it known and seek to hold to account those who are responsible for his treatment, to say this shouldn't happen. This shouldn't happen to anyone. It shouldn't have happened to Faisal, and it must not happen to anybody else. And so I feel a great sense of connection and duty in telling that story as well, to bear witness to that, I suppose, because that's the way we know about these things. That's the way things improve, I think.
Mate, it's journalism can make a difference, just like good friends I've had on this podcast that have even used their own businesses to make a difference. It's incredible to see that whatever it is that we've given as a gift, or we discover as a gift, whether it be the ability to just write and tell a story, you've got a business, you've got a passion for sports, whatever it is that I was reading about these guys in Afghanistan that love skateboarding.
I don't know, Skatistan.
I don't know if you've heard about them.
Yep.
And it just makes me think that so often, you know, we don't think that what we have in our hand actually can make such a profound difference in the lives of other people. And I'm just thank you for dedicating your life to, you know, telling these really important stories and representing and advocating for those Yeah, that don't have a voice. That don't have a voice.
That's immensely kind of you, and you know, to know that you know my sort of work can go out there and can occasionally make a small difference is hugely fulfilling. But like you say, I think so many of us and so many people have that capacity, and you may think that the skills or that you have or the position that you're in is unremarkable, is unexceptional. But I think if we look to our own lives, almost everybody can find a way that they contribute to the greater good, to the benefit of others, to the welfare of their communities and their world. I think we all have that capacity. And it is, you know, I suppose it is the most sort of fundamental thing we can do as human beings, is to look after other human beings.
It is.
You know? We are social creatures. We are family creatures. And there is nothing more fundamental, I'd argue, than reaching a hand out to your fellow human.
It's funny too, because so often our initial reaction, I don't know where it comes from, our need to survive tends to want to like look after ourselves, take care of ourselves, but when really when we take care of those around us, we're actually helping ourselves, like without trying to you know be too self-serving in the long game. But I think it's a fundamental nature of like you said, we're social creatures. We are designed to care for one another, and in that process, you know, we enrich our lives. And I think too, okay, Australia has a responsibility. We can take care of our own self in this world. I think of COVID right now and clamoring for, we've got to have our own vaccines to take care of ourselves, and we can be drawn ourselves into to just kind of be, you know, self-preserving, right? When maybe the answer, even to our own needs and to our own self-preservation in the future, is to actually give and to serve those around us. And I guess I segue into your now role, I guess, Pacific editor, looking over the whole region of the Pacific world of ours, and how important it is, and the responsibility we have as Australians to care about the issues that are on our doorstep, and to care about and to recognise how it actually impacts our own life. And so maybe you could speak into that a little bit.
I think you're right, and you know, to go back to the point you were making about the sort of the micro and the macro, that instinct to turn inwards on a human level can pretty quickly be seen to be self-defeating. You know, as if you were to kind of cut off all contact and interaction with other people, you would quickly, you know, wither and die. Essentially, we are social beings. We need other people around to survive. We need other people. And I think you can apply that to the macro as well. You know, with a crisis like COVID-19, the instinct and I think it's absolutely an understandable instinct is for a nation to kind of turn inwards on itself and look after itself, particularly a nation such as Australia that is so well equipped to deal with something like COVID-19. We're an island nation. We have a good public healthcare system. We're a wealthy nation. We can afford the vaccines, and we've got a relatively small population. All of those sort of things count in our favour and make it easier for us to look after ourselves. But I, like you, think that is a self-defeating and unhelpful instinct, because I think the response to something like this needs to be regional. It needs to be global. Yeah. This is a global pandemic, and you are not safe from it. You are not safe from it while you are surrounded by it. And the countries in our neighbourhood to whom we do owe an obligation, whom we do have not only the wherewithal, but as I say, the obligation to assist. Pacific, you know, our Pacific neighbours are some of the most disadvantaged countries on earth. They face immense challenges in dealing with something like COVID-19. They've got populations with significant comorbidities. They've got weak public health systems. They've got, you know, the basic tyranny of distance. They're archipelago nations spread out over thousands of kilometres of the Pacific Ocean. How do you get a vaccine access that needs to be stored at minus 70 degrees to an outer lying island of the Cook Islands? All you know, like really sort of nuts and bolts practical things. So a country like Australia, I think, has an obligation there. This is our neighbourhood. They are our family. We do need to be out in that part of the world, in the Pacific, in Southeast Asia, doing what we can to assist. And I think that applies then to other issues. And again, we come back to this idea of justice and this yeah. conceptualization of justice as an act of imagination. The Pacific Islands are some of the most vulnerable in the world to the impacts of climate change. Sea level rise in the Western Pacific is some of the fastest in the world, and islands are being threatened today in places like Kiribati, in places like, in Fiji and the Solomon Islands. I mean, this is not, you know, some theoretical future issue. This is something that people are living with now, being inundated, having, you know, storm surges wash over your island, your crops, your house, all of those sorts of things. This is a reality for people on these islands. But in a kind of sense of justice, the Pacific Islands have done almost nothing to contribute to climate change. They're exactly. You know, in terms of carbon output, wow. the Pacific is the smallest region in the world by so far, yet they are feeling the impacts of climate change first and hardest. Mm-hmm. So my question there is, where is the justice in that?
Where?
And perhaps, you know, a just solution involves high-emitting, developed, industrialized countries like Australia, like the US, doing what they can for the Pacific, you know, and whether that's, you know, adaptation and mitigation, whether that's whether that's relocation plans and those sort of things, when some islands sadly do become unlivable, you know, what happens to people then? I think there is an obligation. You know, the developed industrialized world has caused this problem.
Exactly.
What are we going to do to help it? Where is the justice there? I mean, I think it is a terrible and cruel injustice that the countries that have contributed least to global warming are suffering its effects first and hardest. Yeah.
Well, it's almost the same with anything, really. The oppressed, the vulnerable, the poor in any society, whenever there's any form of tragedy, are always the ones that suffer the most. We see when there's economic collapse, you know, or struggles, it seems like the rich get bailed out, or the rich can weather the storm and survive and go through, but it's the mum and dad that scraping ends to meet that seem to end up, you know, hopeless and without anything.
You're absolutely right. I think the pressure is always downwards, and I think again, you know, to come back to that act of imagination. Well, what would it be like if I wasn't sure if I could stay in my house, or, you know, to afford my rent, if I didn't have money to put food on the table, what was it like if the ancestral lands that my family's owned for as many generations as I can count are suddenly no longer livable, are suddenly underwater? You know, to imagine another situation, to imagine another person's circumstance is a significant first step into finding a just solution, I think.
And I always say this to those that have endured, incredible oppression or just gone through great tragedy and trauma. Many families that I've walked alongside and throughout my life. And what I've found, though, is that they have so much to teach us about resiliency, about the ability for even them to be grateful and to push on and to move. I feel like so often, I think we underestimate the incredible gift we have right in front of us, that have come across the shores, that are in our neighborhoods, in our communities. And they too hold the key as well. So it's almost like it's not just this obligation or guilt sometimes that can drive the change, but it's like that creative imagination of, well, if they can overcome what they've overcome, maybe you could put yourselves in their situation, learn a little something from them. You know, it's again being led and pushed on, maybe by gratitude instead of guilt, to a certain degree. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I find, yeah. Do you think that the experiences that you've been through, you know, living with, Yazidi families in northern Iraq and the oppression that they face, I mean, to see their resilience? Has that helped you in your life? Do you think to be able to say, you know what, I can get through this. This 100%. Is a setback, but I can get through this.
100%. And you what as someone who's kind of holds on dearly to my Christian faith, my favorite verse is that to God is with the brokenhearted. And I think it was Bono who said to I think a prayer breakfast in America, he says he addresses the crowd, he says he's in the slums, he's in the streets, this is where he is. And and there's this sense of beauty, even in the midst of the great pain and the sorrow, that is found in that presence. It breaks through your own soul, and it's taken me to places of obviously tremendous heartache and pain, and sometimes it's hard to kind of move on from something like you sharing your story. I'm almost feeling the tears of what that would have been like to walk in the shoes of and be amongst these girls and to see their place. It can't do anything but change you, and I feel like there is this supernatural moment, this experience that happens in that place of I think great pain and suffering, but I think it must and always should lead us to this. It cannot be the way it must end. You know, there's got to be something that draws you on. But
That's a really in that kind of right in that moment of crisis. There is a calm and a resilience that an extraordinary resilience that people can find to pull themselves through that to draw themselves forward.
Yeah, we one of the key programs we've delivered not only in Iraq, but here in Australia, is a post-traumatic growth program, which really kind of spends time in a very group format, walking through maybe obviously they've gone through incredible trauma, they've gone through suffering, they've displacement, loss, grief, before PTSD or before some of the more systemic long-term problems get kind of sealed into someone's life when they go through something. There's an opportunity in that crisis, you know, to potentially actually use what you're going through to make you stronger, more resilient and better. And what are some of those key characteristics that you can foster? Are there key things you can teach somebody in that moment or through that process? And they've, you know, discovered, you know, these principles of gratitude, of kindness, of this. And I think you've summed it up well in this phrase of this act of imagination, you know, of being able to shift your perspective and to something, you know, and again, you know, you can't fast track that, you know. Grief and pain and trauma is something that just, you know, has its own time. You know, that it needs to be processed. But I think being surrounded and in an environment where you're able to look forward in those moments and rebuild can be really, really critical for people that go through that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd love to just get behind the scenes of like your actual you know, your skill of crafting a story. I mean, I know some people that are prolific writers and they sit down and they write 1,000 words a day and then they finally, you know, like they only, you know, they do that because at the end of the day they might only have a few words that are good, but they, you know, they just proliferate and write and write and write. But for you, you've often got quite a quick time frame to push stories through, or there's just maybe you're working on a really long story. What is it that, you know, that you employ? What's your kind of secret sauce, let's say.
I wish I knew what it was. I suppose, yeah, I mean, as they say, journalism, you know, that sort of rough draft or first draft of history, like it often is very quickly written. News stories need to be turned around quite quickly. I do think there is a difference. There are some news stories that are kind of for the moment, and you write them, and your writing there is very functional, and it's just about the kind of sort of, you know, as seamless as possible transmission of information from mm-hmm. from my fingers to into the minds of whoever's reading. I think there is a different process for those sort of longer, more in-depth pieces where you really need to, you need a lot of time and you need a lot of headspace to kind of get into a story. And I mean, when I'm writing a piece like that, I will sort of seal myself off a bit, you know, phone goes off or on the silent, and I, you know, email notifications, everything else goes off, and it's just kind of, you've kind of got to live in that story. And that's very much the only way I find I can write. And sometimes finding the voice or the essence of what I want to bring out can take a little time. There can be, you know, several false starts, and, you know, and I remember, you know, writing some pieces that have gone through, you know, 16, 17, 18 drafts before I kind of get them right. Whereas some news stories, you write top to bottom.
Yeah.
Perfect. Out it goes. And that's, you know, that's an important functional news tool, but there are other stories that you kind of live with and that are, you know, that are kind of creations that you want to be really proud of, that you want every word right, that you go through again for the 40th time just to go, is that comma in exactly the right spot? Am I reflecting exactly what I'm trying to convey here? So those pieces, you know, you live with quite intensely while they're with you, and you feel very kind of proprietal, almost kind of paternal about them, and then you have to send them out into the world for other people to read and to criticize and to like or to not like and those sort of things, and it's hugely rewarding when something that you feel is important and a story that you felt is vital to get out into the world sort of lands on fertile ground, you know, and you see people respond, people call you up, people write you letters, people send you emails or on Twitter or whatever, or you know, we get letters to the Guardian or something, you know, that you see that it's resonating with people, and that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's kind of, you know, going to agree with you, but that you've made a kind of valued contribution that people have taken the time to read and consider. So
I can imagine it's almost like that.
There's a sense of letting go and a sort of sense of powerlessness once you send it out into the world, that it's not yours anymore. It belongs to everybody else, and that can be full on.
I can imagine sometimes there's that essence to a piece or that you don't even know what it is, that somehow it's like a song that suddenly hits the charts and they've written 1,000 songs before that they like better, but somehow this one.
Yeah,
there was something about it, and that's the beauty, I think, of that human element to it. Mm. There's something very
and something slightly charming in the unpredictability of it. You never quite know how things are going to land, and what's going to resonate with people.
Yeah,
and that's all.
It's all part of it.
Part of the allure.
And you've taken your pen to writing a book as well. Can you talk a little about that? Is that all right? Can we?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love talking about Nagaland, and that's kind of almost kind of. Yeah, I mean, look, I love talking about it because it takes me back to this place. Nagaland, which is behind me there.
Yep.
There it is. I wrote a novel, and I never thought I'd write a novel. I never had ambitions to be a novelist. But this was a story that called me. I forced itself upon me and sort of knocked at the front of my skull saying, you haven't told me yet. You haven't told me yet. So it gives me immense joy to know that it's out in the world and people can read it. The book is called Nagaland. And Nagaland is a tiny, almost forgotten state of India. This is a very difficult to do on a podcast. India's sort of diamond shape, roughly. you know, Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Calcutta, but it also goes up and over the other side of Bangladesh. And there are seven states there, seven small mountainous states. I sort of call them the seven sisters. And the sort of furthest and most remote and smallest one is called Nagaland. And it's the home of the Naga people, who are ethnically much more closely related to the Tibetans and the Burmese, and have always felt a very strong sense of disconnection from India. So I stumbled into this story in a very sort of strange way. I used to play in a rock band in Delhi. I played in a rock and roll band called the Chum Chum, and we turned up for a gig one night, and you know, like, people would come and watch us play, but not that many. And this place was full. It was heaving, and it was full of Naga people. And the band who were playing before us were called the Featherheads. And my first sight of Augustine, who was the protagonist of this book, was Augustine stripped to the waist, you know, shirtless with long hair but shaved at the sides, and a feather from a hornbill bird stuck out the back of his head. And he was singing in Nagamese, their sort of shared language between the various Naga tribes. It's their communal language. And this incredibly powerful song, and just this captivating man to look at, like, absolutely extraordinary. He was also decorated in the sort of tattoos of the Naga people, including the facial tattoos of the ancient headhunters. And so this sort of compelling matter, the Featherheads were a support band for us, and it should have been the other way around, because they were much better than us, and they had many more, you know, fans than we did. We had this extraordinary gig, and then afterwards I was talking to Augustine, and I asked him about Nagaland, and I was a correspondent in that part of the world, and I was aware of Nagaland but knew nothing about it. And he started to tell the stories of his childhood and his people. It was just utterly compelling. He said, "You'll have to come one day." And I sort of thought it was this sort of throwaway line, but from then on, Augustine and I would see each other around the place, and we fell into this curious friendship where he would just appear in my life and then disappear again. And he appeared one day when I had dengue fever and was sort of writhing on the floor in pain with this strange concoction in a Coke bottle, this was strange green bubbling liquid that he forced me to drink. I don't know if it
helped,
you know,
or not.
Yeah, helped or hindered, but I'm here telling you the story. So anyway, and eventually he said, "No, you really must come to Nagaland." And so I went up there and I found this extraordinary community up there. These communities. He was from a place called Akrul, which is technically in Manipur, but is part of the sort of the broader Naga community. I met with his family, and I stayed with his family, and we would go to his village, and we would sit, and in the morning we'd wake up and say, "Which direction are we going to walk?" And we would walk along the ridges of these hills. Like, these are the foothills of the Himalayas. They lead up to Mount Everest. They're very high mountains. And we would walk from village to village, and we would sit down, and we would share stories, and we'd share food. And I was drawn into this extraordinary world of the Naga people, about which I knew nothing. And I had no intention of writing a story or anything. It was just a sort of very profound and spectacular place.
Wow.
And I left Nagaland. I left India and came back to Australia just before the birth of my first child. And about a year after that, a package arrived, this sort of battered yellow envelope, and it was postmarked Nagaland. And I opened it up, and it was Augustine's diary, this leather-bound diary that he would carry everywhere he went, and was filled with song lyrics and maps and drawings of hornbills. The hornbill is a very sacred bird to the Naga people. And it was this intensely personal and intensely important book that he had everywhere. And in a moment of personal crisis, he needed to keep that book safe, and he sent it to the first place he could think of where it would be safe, and that was to me in Australia. And from there, this story unspooled. So the novel is an interesting novel in that, well, I say it's interesting in that it lives in the hinterland between Augustine's life experience and the struggles of the Naga people. There's been an insurgency for independence since the independence of India. For 60 years, the Naga people have been ravaged by a heroin epidemic and an HIV epidemic, which followed through, you know, dislocation and interrupted schooling and economic disadvantage and oppression, significant violence from the military, but also Augustine's role as the keeper of his people's stories. And the book lives in the hinterland between Augustine's life story, the history of the Naga people, and the myths and legends of those people. And it's all told through the diary and Augustine's moment of crisis, I suppose. And it's also a love story. So I've crammed a fair bit in. So, but it was, as I say, a story I never thought I would write. I never envisaged myself writing. But once the diary came to me, there was this obligation, this compulsion. And I even tried to put it away a few times. I'd write drafts and then stick it in a drawer and say,
really?
I can't do it. It's too difficult. I can't write this story.
Wow.
But it would keep coming back to me and said, you haven't told me yet. And so eventually I realized that I had to tell this story, and that story is Nagaland. And it's really nice to talk about. And I know I've sort of rambled on a bit, but
I wish we talked more about this.
Everybody I talk to about Nagaland, or everybody who reads Nagaland, you know, Augustine's story lives on in another person. There's another person who knows about the Naga, who knows about Augustine's story. And that feels to me like that's been my purpose with this, is to keep his story and the story of the Naga, you know, alive a little more. So I'm always happy to talk about Nagaland.
Oh, man, that's phenomenal. It feels quite fitting to kind of wrap things up, just kind of talking about a story, you know, the theme of really what I want the podcast to really emphasize is a world where everyone belongs, even the Naga, you know, Naga people. Mm. And we don't know until we hear. And thank you, thanks for kind of taking Augustine's story, his people, and sharing it, carrying it along. Yeah. And you've done that, I think, in a lot of your work. And I've really been looking forward to spending, having this conversation with you, spending this time catching up again. It's been a while. Last, you know, if you could sum this up in a couple of sentences, what is it that gives you hope? I know when you answered the question of why does justice matter, as we were kind of prepping for this, you talked about this world being more and more fractured, and yet justice is about bringing things together. What in the back frame of when you of seeing a this world and the hopelessness that there seems to be in how divided and how unequal it has become, what drives you on? What inspires you? Is there somebody that inspires you? What is it that gives you hope for the future? Because I think that holds the key for us to keep going.
I think you're right. There are certain people that inspire me in different ways and in different situations. But I think humanity, sort of resilience and kind of fundamental optimism, is the thing that drives me. I mean, you know, and I think because there's always tomorrow, because tomorrow is yet to be dictated, because tomorrow has potential to be better than today, that's what sort of that's what sort of drives us on. And I'm consistently, as you know, as you were reflecting earlier in your experiences with the Yazidi, even in these times of immense crisis, and I don't think that too many people would contest that the world is going through a very difficult time at the moment. We are facing significant crises on a number of fronts, that there is a calm and a resilience that exists there, and an almost spiritual stillness that you can say, we can make tomorrow better than today, and we can take small steps to make things better. I think there is a fundamental underlying resilience in humanity and an underlying optimism, and I think that's what drives us all through.
Yeah, well said, mate. Thanks again.
Mate, Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure. I could honestly talk all day. It's been absolutely thoroughly enjoyed it. And let's not make it so long before we catch up again soon. But that'll be fantastic.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Justice Matters. I'd like to take this time to thank my audio-visual engineer, Jose Biotto, for your help in producing the show. I'd also like to shout out to the Patreon community that financially supports this podcast. Guys, thank you so much for your support. You can join them simply by going to patreon.com/justicematters. For a simple donation of $5 a month, you can become a part of the Patreon community and get access to behind-the-scenes content and extras that I share just with you. And lastly, there is another really important way that you can help support the podcast, and that's simply by rating it or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. maybe by subscribing on YouTube. Yes, we are a video podcast as well. Guys, thank you so much for listening in to this episode of Justice Matters. Please come again soon. We can't wait to share more episodes with you. I'm your host, Tim Buxton. Thanks for listening.